This is Book Club Cheats, a podcast for book clubbers who just can't seem to find the time to read. I'm your host, Lipitana Raman, and today we'll be talking about His Only Wife by Pies Adjo-Mede. The other day, I was watching snippets of the new series on the last months of Anne Boleyn's life, starring Jodie Turner-Smith. As a history nerd, I will read and watch anything and everything about the Tudors. Soap operas have nothing on this bunch. My mom has been fascinated by Henry VIII and his six wives for as long as I can remember. She just can't get over the fact that Henry got through six wives. There is a little bit of shock and awe in her fascination, I think. My dad's take on Henry is totally different. Henry was obviously an idiot, according to my dad. How else would he have the will, fortitude, and savviness to deal with one wife, never mind six? Pies Adjo-Mede's His Only Wife explores patriarchy, multiple wives, and marriage in contemporary Ghana. There are three forms of Ghanaian marriage. Two forms, customary and Islamic, can be polygamous. The third, an ordinance marriage performed by a government-licensed marriage officer, a priest or an imam, is the only form of monogamous legal marriage in Ghana. The customary marriage is essentially a marriage union between families and is solemnized by local customs. The customs are different, really, depending on which ethnic group you belong to. His Only Wife is a domestic drama and told in first-person narrative. The narrator is Afi Tekli, a 21-year-old living in a provincial town in Ghana. The story is told in a linear fashion and covers roughly a year and a half in Afi's life. The writing is straightforward, easy breezy, and is engaging. In addition to the marriage, the story tackles the conflict between and pressures of balancing tradition, modernity, ideals of womanhood, relationships between young and old, ideas of and ideals of family, notions of acceptable social behaviors for males and females, family honor, class, sugar baby culture, money and love, jealousy, betrayal, and familial expectations in a rapidly changing Ghana. His Only Wife opens with a great line. Elkan married me in absentia. He did not come to our wedding. The opening sentences really pulled me into the story. Afi Tekli gets married to Elkan or Eli in a traditional customary big fat Ghanaian wedding. Family is all important in Ghana. Afi's uncle Pius tells her, a person is nothing without family. As Afi's father is dead, her uncle Pius presides and lords over the family and the wedding. Pius has multiple wives and children. He thinks a lot of himself, is selfish, and is quite conniving. Pius has co-opted the ancestral home as his personal fiefdom. Whatever rooms his large family doesn't occupy, he rents out. Afi, her mother, and her two uncles, excellent and bright, love the names, are shafted from benefiting from their heritage. Richard and Fred, Eli's brothers, Yaya, his sister, and auntie, Eli's mother, attend the wedding. The ceremony and wedding are a lot of fun for everyone, but Afi. Page 8. Agu, the Simi began, demanding everyone's attention. We all wanted to see what the Ganyus, with all their money, would bring. We had given them a modest list of the gifts we wanted, but there had been talk that instead of the 2 bottles of schnapps, they would give 10 boxes of Black Label whiskey, and instead of a gift-wrapped suitcase stuffed with panties, bras and yards of cloth, nightgowns, necklaces and earrings, and the other basics that every woman needs when starting a new life, they would come with a gift-wrapped 4x4 vehicle, the interior of which would be a mini boutique. I confess that I broke into a wide smile at that bit of gossip. First, here are the drinks. 5 more bottles of schnapps, 5 crates of soft drinks, 5 crates of beer, 5 crates of Guinness, 2 gallons of palm wine. The Simi boomed as though he was announcing the prize on a game show. He then invited my relatives to inspect the bride price that my soon-to-be husband, through his siblings, had brought and placed in another room in the house. My Aunt Sylvia, who was my father's only sister, and other women from my father's side went to inspect the items. They came out about 5 minutes later and told the Simi that all was in order, that the Ganyos had not disappointed. In fact, they had done way more than requested. Papa, we know how you have suffered for your daughter, so we are not simply going to take her away like that. No, not at all, the Siami intoned. We know that it was not a small thing to raise a good daughter in today's Ghana. One who is respected and humble, despite her looks, he continued to the murmurs of agreement. A daughter who has both school education and home education. A daughter who can read a book and cook a tasty pot of soup. He paused for dramatic effect. That is why we did not come with small gifts. We came with gifts that matched the work you have done. The Siamese voice rose to cries of yo from the eager guests. We came with spectacular gifts, magnificent gifts, gargantuan gifts, he cried to fevered applause and adulation. Shh, he whispered half-heartedly. After the noise died down, there was a rustling of paper as the gifts exchanged hands, and Toga Pius's breathy Akpi, 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 repeated on the Siami, interrupted him. I'm sure he would have continued thanking the gynos all day if the Siami hadn't stopped him. I wouldn't have been surprised if my dear uncle collapsed in a quivering mound of joy. Of course he was happy to receive a reward for work he had never bothered to do. Eli has a long-time living girlfriend and a daughter who he doesn't want to give up. So why does Afi get married to a guy she doesn't really know, who's quite a bit older than her and who's obviously is emotionally and physically entangled with someone else? Well, Afi is blackmailed emotionally and economically into the marriage. Afi's father, Illustrious, died when Afi was 11. The government house that they lived in was repossessed, and Afi and her mother, Olivia, literally found themselves on the streets. Pius and other family members refused to help. In fact, they enjoyed Olivia's downfall. Olivia and Illustrious were married in a church, so Olivia was Illustrious's only wife. Illustrious tried hard to balance his love of his wife with his responsibility to his extended family. Olivia hadn't got along with her in-laws, and she wouldn't allow them to use her home as they pleased, and according to them, hadn't fully supported them. When Olivia and Afi were homeless, two women helped them. Davy Christie, one of Pius's wives, gave them a home in her rooms, and Faustina Gagno, or Auntie as everyone called her, helped Olivia with the living. Auntie, a self-made millionaire, gives Olivia a job and later a house. Okay, maybe the house is rickety and not as spiffy as the government bungalow, but it's a roof over their heads. Indebted, Olivia and Afi would do anything for Auntie, and that's how Afi ends up marrying Eli, who's in love with another woman. Auntie is a complete control freak. She expects all her children and employees to jump to her tune. On business in Liberia, Eli meets the Liberian woman. Everyone in the book refers to the girlfriend as that, the Liberian woman. In the middle of the book, Afi finds out the woman actually has a name, Muna. That woman, according to Eli's family, apparently has put some sort of spell over him. The guy falls hard for her in the first week that he's in Liberia. She traps him by pregnancy, and when the baby dies, she quickly gets pregnant again, only to give birth to a sickly little girl, Ivy. The family, Auntie, Yaya, Richard, tell Afi and everyone that will listen that the manly featured Liberian woman is tall, hard, has a flat butt, no breasts, and is dark. The Liberian woman smokes, wears jeans in ancestral gatherings, doesn't observe or respect Ghanaian customs. Why, she can't even cook Ghanaian food. She refuses to stay in the ancestral home or mix with ancestral villagers, doesn't let Eli's family hang out or know Ivy, and refuses to let them in his home. I have to say, the woman sounded insane and vile. Auntie forbids Eli from marrying the Liberian woman and is backed up by Eli's elder uncles. Auntie decides the way to fix all their troubles is for beautiful, light-skinned Afi to marry Eli, be a good wife, and slowly peel Eli away from the Liberian woman. I didn't think this was such a hot idea, but hey, I'm not a self-made businesswoman, so what do I know? Obviously, both Eli and Afi obeyed Auntie against their will. Richard sets Afi and Olivia up in a luxury apartment in the Ghanaian capital, Accra. Eli and all his things are missing from the apartment, though. Afi and Olivia, who's come to make sure that Afi completes her mission of being a good wife, are totally blown away with the sumptuous apartment and all the wealth. Olivia thinks that the kitchen is just too fancy to pound spices for their traditional foods. With nothing to do, the two women spend a lot of time cleaning an already spotless apartment. Bored with waiting around for Eli to turn up, Affy starts to explore, chatting with the guards at the apartment complex, and finds out about Richard's secret girlfriend, Evelyn, who lives opposite her. Affy, an expert seamstress, decides that she wants to enroll in fashion school. Her mother thinks it's a bad idea. She just got married. It's better to stay home, get to know her husband, take care of him. I don't know how that's going to work. Eli still hasn't made an appearance. Richard thinks it's a good idea, but that she should run it by Eli. Finally, the mythical Eli comes. A nervous Affy spent the better part of her day cooking yummy Ghanaian delicacies just for him. Page 7076.
Are you well? He asked. He looked at my mother, then at me as he said this. We are well, she replied. I remained quiet like a child in the presence of two adults having a conversation. Well, I brought your wife and decided to stay with her as she waited for you, my mother continued. Thank you, he said. Are you well? He asked again, this time looking directly at me. I nodded and then managed a weak smile. He nodded as though satisfied. Your wife cooked something small for you, my mother said. Oh, thank you, he said, his eyes on me. Please, you are welcome, I said. A moment later, I felt a sharp pinch on my back. It was my mother. She swirled her eyes in the direction of the kitchen when I turned to look at her. I shot to my feet. Please, I'm going for the food, I mumbled, and hurried to the kitchen. He chatted with my mother as I heated the stews, but twice when I looked over at them, he was staring at me. I lowered my head and only looked at him again when I went to announce that the food was ready. I noticed how tall he was when he stood up. I had been too flustered when he first walked in to note this. He was taller than 6 feet, which, when compared to my 5 feet 2 inches, was a lot. He seemed bigger than when I last saw him, his chest and his shoulders broader, but unlike Richard, he did not have a paunch. He moved easily, like a much smaller man, but when he sat at the table, he was imposing. Maybe it was because he was sitting at the head of the table. Aren't you going to eat? He asked me when I remained standing. Please, I've already eaten, I lied. But I can't eat alone, so come sit with me, he said, pointing to the chair next to him. Yes, sir, sit with your husband. I'm going to my room, my mother called from the sitting room. When I turned to look at her, she was standing out of Eli's view and was blinking rapidly. I knew she was warning me not to do anything that could displease him or her or Auntie or anyone in Ho who had chosen me as the solution to the problem. The sweat from my armpits began to drip down my sides. I sat on the edge of the dining table and began to take slices of yam out of the Pyrex bowl and place them onto his plate as I had seen my mother do for my father when he would come home from work. That's okay, he said after I had placed the 4th slice on his plate. Please, do you want garden egg or contemporary? I asked in a small voice, suddenly worried that he would not like either. I'll start with the contemporary, he asked. I quickly began to scoop the greens onto his plate, careful to drain the excess palm oil out of the spoon before serving him. I hoped that my fast movements would prevent him from seeing my shaking hand. He began to eat as soon as I finished. He smiled after swallowing the first mouthful. Very good, he said, and then dug in again. I beamed, pleased with myself. I wished my mother had been there to hear him, and Auntie as well. So, how are you liking it here? He said to me in English. Fine, it's fine. It's quiet, and not like Ho. I nodded, and then smiled, but my smile faded as I began to believe that he would take offence at what I had said. I didn't want him to think that I was complaining about Accra. But I like it here very much, I said quickly. He looked up, his eyebrows arched. I think he was surprised by the force at which I spoke, because I had been whispering and mumbling since he came in. What have you been doing? Please, walking around the area, going to the market, housework. He was quiet for a while and then asked me, isn't there anything else that you want to do? Anything else? I asked cautiously. Yes, to keep busy. I paused as I remembered my mother's rapidly blinking eyes and her suggestion that I wait a year before starting my training. But I really wanted to start, and Richard hadn't discouraged me when I had told this to him. In fact, he had said that it was a great idea. Why would his brother react any differently? Please, I want to go to fashion school, sewing school. That's great. Which one? Please, I'm thinking about that. Okay, I'll ask Yaya to help look. Thank you, I said, relieved. It was only after this that I realized that we, as husband and wife, had had a conversation. My relief disappeared when he insisted on helping me take away the dishes and leaned on the counter beside me when I washed them. His presence was disconcerting and made the hairs on my arm stand up. Why don't you use the dishwasher? He asked. Please, it's faster this way, I said. I didn't tell him that I hadn't tried to use the machine before, mainly because my mother thought we would break it and was embarrassed to try to figure it out in front of him. We went back to the sitting room after this, but he didn't sit down. Instead, he picked up his phones off the center table and told me that he was leaving. Now? Yes, I have a meeting. Please call your mother so I can tell her bye. I wanted to ask him if he would be coming back later, but I daren't. I rather went to my mother and stood behind her as they spoke. Afi, thank you for lunch, he said. Please, you are welcome, I responded. I didn't follow him out into the hallway to wait for the lift, despite the jerky movements from my mother's eyeballs were making. I needed to sit and think. I needed to make sense of the afternoon. Was this it? Was this my marriage? The short visit, the awkward conversation. This wasn't what I had imagined. It certainly wasn't what I wanted. It's true that I was afraid of messing everything up, but I also wanted to be given the chance to try to make it work. How else would I repay Auntie and create the life I dreamed of? Effie doesn't see Eli for 2 months after that. She keeps preparing dishes for him and is always disappointed when Eli is a no-show. Eli calls her every day, though. He opens up about his many projects, partners, and travels. No mention of the girlfriend or daughter, though. Afi enjoys talking to Eli and starts to long for him in person. I suppose she's falling in love. Afi is still shy and demure with Eli. She doesn't have the courage to talk to Eli the way that she really wants to. Auntie comes to visit and she's happy with how her plan is going. She tells Afi that it's not natural for a man to defy his whole family and elders for a woman, especially not that kind of woman. Afi has to be patient, call to God, and basically show her husband what he's missing. Olivia, to Afi's relief, goes back home with Auntie. Every week, Eli sends Afi wads of money by her driver. Afi uses some, sends some to her mom, and hilariously puts the rest of it in her suitcase. Later on, Afi bills her mom a house back home with the money. Afi enrolls in fashion school, headed by Sarah, who studied in London. It's a small operation run out of the house, but Afi loves it and learns a lot. Afi gets into a routine, being chauffeured to school and then the market and speaking with Eli and her cousin and best friend Mausi every day. Afi also starts to spend more time with Yaya, who takes her to an upper-class party. It's full of sophisticated, cosmopolitan, jet-setting, hip and mobile people, up-and-coming business people, bankers, actors and aid workers. Afi feels out of place with nothing to say to any of these people, but Yaya tells her that she'll get used to it. Afi meets Evelyn, Richard's secret girlfriend, who Auntie hates and has told Richard to get rid of. Evelyn is open and straightforward, too straightforward for Afi at times. Evelyn works in PR and is a businesswoman. She owns a brick-making company and 4 houses. Evelyn's poor mother sent her to live with an uncle in the city. Her uncle basically used her like a servant, so Evelyn ran away, lived on the streets and was taken in by a man who expected sexual favours in return for a roof over her head. Evelyn tells Afi, nothing is free in this city. Evelyn finally lets Afi know that the librarian woman's name is Muna, and that contrary to what Auntie has been saying, Muna is nice and was helpful to Evelyn. Evelyn questions why Afi would believe Auntie's version of Muna, because she knows that Auntie is bossy, a bully, holds grudges, and is a total control freak. The family tell Afi that Muna found out about Afi and Eli's marriage and that she had a huge fight with Eli and took Ivy to Spain. Soon after, Eli comes to take her out to lunch. He's going to help her open a boutique of her designs and he's going to take her with him on his next business trip. Eli comes over to the flat. Afi cooks and they make love. Afi can't wait to tell her mom. She's overjoyed with the happy news.
Olivia cannot also wait to tell Auntie and the rest of the family. Basically, everyone in the Tu family knows Abby's business, whether she wants them to not. Eli brings along his clothes and toiletries in a travel bag to keep in the apartment. The couple fall in a humdrum domestic routine. Eli takes Abby to clubs and business weekends and introduces her to his friends and business partners. At a business weekend, Abby accidentally overhears Eli tell his colleagues that it's not easy keeping Muna, Abby and his mother happy. One friend tells Eli he should choose one woman for his own sense of peace, but Eli tells them that he likes both women and he can't decide. An upset Abby confronts Eli about Muna. Eli gets mad and Abby understands that the mention of the Liberian woman is out of bounds. Anytime Abby mentions their situation, how she's the wife, who what needs to happen, Eli shuts her down with, "It's a complicated thing. I'm working on it. It will take time." Evelyn tells Abby Eli hasn't left Muna. She's on vacation and that's why Eli is spending time with Abby. Muna lives with Eli in his actual house and Evelyn suggests that Abby should ask to be moved into Eli's house. Abby will then know where she stands. Abby knows that Evelyn is right, but she's scared. Evelyn tells Abby she can't be scared of her own husband, that if Abby can't share her feelings with her husband, who can she share it with? Abby finds out that she's pregnant, and Eli and the whole family are thrilled, more so when they find out it's a boy. Abby tells herself things are not going to change immediately, but she's sure that it will eventually. A more confident Abby pushes to move into Eli's house. Eli comes back with his to-go-to excuse. It's complicated. It'll take time. But Abby wants a date. She also realizes that if she doesn't do something now, she's going to be stuck in that flat forever. That Abby has to fight for what she wants. She leaves and goes back home. Abby won't come back unless she can live in Eli's house. Olivia and Auntie freak out. Olivia basically hides Abby at home. She doesn't want anyone to know her shame. What will people say? And she's also scared of Auntie. And Auntie? Well, Auntie is just plain mad that Abby is not listening to her. Abby is frustrated that no one, Eli, her mother and Auntie, no one's listening to her. An angry Eli eventually comes to her and takes Abby home to his house. But it's not a fun situation. The staff are rude to Abby, Eli sleeps in another room, and the house has antiquated, horrible furniture. She just doesn't like it. Not the fun times that Abby expected in this house. The scare of Abby falling down the stairs thaws the situation somewhat. Eli moves back into the bedroom, and life gets into a much more even keel of a routine. Eli's family comes over to the house, and it's really a one big happy family. Eventually, Abby delivers her son, Selram, and the family pass an idyllic year. A besotted and indulgent Eli routinely lets the little boy play with all his cell phones. Eli is a devoted husband, father, brother and son. The Liberian woman is nowhere on the horizon. A year after her son's birth, Abby has a successful upscale boutique, and in a couple of weeks, she and Eli are going to go to Paris. Life is good. However, Maosi, her cousin, reminds Abby that she didn't have a church marriage, that the traditional marriage that she had only recognises Abby as the first wife, not the only wife. Evelyn, who's handling the PR for Abby's boutique, lines up a photo shot in another ritzy part of the city. At the shoot, the photographer is rude to a neighbour's child, and Abby, holding Selram, goes to apologise.
Page 257. The house next door was a replica of the one we had rented. My arms were aching by the time I got there. Selram, now asleep, was heavy, his head on my shoulder. The glass door was open and high life music played in the background. The woman met me at the door. "Hello," she said, looking puzzled. I figured strangers didn't come to her door often. "Hi," I responded, staring at her. I don't think I'd ever seen a more beautiful woman in my life. Not in person, anyway. She had the darkest skin I'd ever seen, but it glowed. I imagined that what gold would look like if it were black. She had a heart-shaped face, high cheekbones and was slim and much taller than I was. Her limbs made me think of ballet dancers that I had glimpsed on TV as I clicked through channels. I imagined that she did everything gracefully. A flowing ocean blue halter neck dress billowed around her in the sea breeze, and she was barefoot. I could build my entire ad campaign around her. It would be unfair to place any other model beside her in a shoot. Behind her, four children were bent over a large jigsaw puzzle on the floor. I immediately knew which one was hers. "I'm from next door. I came to see if your daughter is okay," I said while doing my best not to gawk. She took a step back into the house, and I realized that my staring was making her uncomfortable. I, too, took a step back. "She's okay. Thanks for coming." There was no reason for him to touch her. She would have moved if he'd asked. I don't know why people behave like this. She didn't sound Ghanaian. "That's what I told him. I'm so sorry." "I appreciate," she began, but was interrupted by someone in the house. "Babe, who is it?" "It's someone from next door," she yelled back. Even her yell was graceful, smooth, like a musical note. "Who?" he asked, walking out of the kitchen. He stopped when he saw me. "Affy? Eli?" I'd often fantasized about what I would do when I met the woman. Those fantasies varied depending on my mood. I would slap her and walk away without saying a word, or I would give her a vicious tongue-lashing that would leave her sobbing and begging for my forgiveness. I would call her a shameless husband-snatcher and a home-wrecker. I would undulate so that everyone around would gather and she huddled on the ground in a public place and join me in humiliating her. I would punish her for all the heartache she had caused me, for all the sleepless nights and the tears. But now I just stood there staring at Eli, and the only thing I could think was that the Ganyos had lied to me. They had told me she was ugly, but there she was, the most beautiful woman I'd ever seen. We were motionless, except for Selram, who lifted his head off my shoulder. I don't know if it was because he sensed something was wrong or if he'd heard his father's voice, but when he turned his head, Ivy shouted his name and came running onto the porch. Her mother held her shoulders and stopped her before she could reach me. To my surprise, Selram reached out both hands to the woman. I took a step back and held him closer to me. "Affy, let's go." It was Evelyn. I hadn't heard her come up behind me. Despite her words, I couldn't get myself to move. I couldn't take my eyes off Eli. He was shirtless and wearing swim shorts. He had a dish towel in his hand. He was staring at me, confusion and guilt mingled on his face. I felt a grip on my arm. Evelyn tugged until I began to move, and then she guided me off the porch and onto the sand. As we walked away, Selram fidgeting and still trying to get away from me, I turned to look back. Eli and the woman were still standing where I had left them. They were looking at me, but he didn't come after me. Affy realizes Auntie and her whole family have told her a bunch of lies. They didn't like Muna and how she treated them, so they fabricated untruths about the woman. Affy discovers Selram playing with one of Eli's unlocked phones. On it, she finds 74 messages that Eli has sent Muna that week. Many of the texts were sent when Eli and Affy were in bed together. The text told Muna that Eli missed her smile, her body. He wished she was in his arms. He couldn't wait to see her. He adored her and he loved her. Affy confronts Eli. Page 263. "I'm sorry. I never wanted this to happen. I'm sorry," he said. His voice was low and he was not making eye contact. "What am I going to do with your sorry, Eli? We can make this work. Are you ever going to leave her?" "Affy, let's not do this." "Okay, marry me," I said, desperation causing my words to come out in a rush. "What?" "I said marry me. Let's go to church on Monday and get married. Father Wisdom can arrange everything, and we can be married in less than 30 minutes. "What are you talking about? We are traveling on Monday. There's a flight to Paris every day, and the airlines won't charge you a fee for changing the dates because of frequent flyer status. You told me yourself. Not that it would matter if they charged you. So let's leave on Tuesday. But on Monday, let's go to Ho and get married." "Affy, why? This is not the time." "This is the time. Now. If you love me, let's get married in church." "Affy, you know. Stop. Just stop. I don't want to hear about you sorting things out. I don't want to hear any of that. Just be honest with me. Will you marry me or not? Just for once, Eli, tell me the truth. He sighed and leaned back in the wrought iron garden chair. His weight pushed the legs deeper in the soil. He looked down at the phone which he had placed on his lap, and then he looked back up at me. I can't do that, Affy. I can't marry you. I'm sorry. His voice shook. Because you want to marry her. You want to marry her when your mother dies. You want to marry her, and you want her to be equal with me, and you know that we both can't have a church wedding. So if we both can't have a church wedding, then neither of us will have it. He didn't say a word. Was there ever a moment in this marriage when you thought of me as the only one, when you wanted only me? He didn't answer me. Why do you love her so much? Why am I not enough for you? I said, my voice breaking. Affy, you know I love you, but you love her more than me, don't you? What kind of question is that, Affy? It's a very simple question. Yes or no? Do you love her more than me? I love you both. Do you love her more? I love you both. You love us both so that you'll marry us both, because you're special and deserve to have everything you want. Everything. But I don't deserve to have what I want, what I've suffered for. You will still be my wife, my first wife. It won't be any different from the arrangement we have now. We both know you plan to go back to how things were, to sleeping in two homes and driving around Accra with a travelling bag in the trunk of your car. It's only a matter of time. This shows that you're putting on for your mother, that you're not going to, it's not going to last forever. I'm not ready to go back to that. I won't go back to lying in bed alone and crying for you. Crying for you while you take my son to live in another woman's house. Affy, don't say my name. And don't you dare call our marriage an arrangement. We don't have an arrangement. I'm your wife. Your family married me for you. All of our relatives were there. Father Wisdom was there. I'm your wife. That doesn't mean I can't have a second wife. Please be reasonable, Affy. Reasonable? You are wicked. You are a liar. I never lied to you. I never told you I was going to leave her. Never.
Affy decides to divorce Eli. She personally returns the traditional bottles of schnapps to Auntie, who promptly smashes them. She doesn't care what people say. Olivia tries to talk Affy out of the divorce. She's pragmatic. Says Eli's a good man. She'll have a good life with Eli. And what will people say? People will talk if she divorces him. And even educated women like doctors and lawyers are co-wives. It's uncommon, but people do it. Affy tells Olivia she can't share Eli, that the loneliness and depression will hurt her, that lots of women get divorced and she'll be okay. Olivia wants to know where Affy can find another man like Eli to marry. Affy replies that she doesn't want to marry a man like Eli again. Affy, Olivia and Soram move into the bedrooms at the back of the boutique. And business is really good and Affy will be expanding overseas. She lets Eli see Soram but won't let him take him to see Muna. Muna doesn't get to move back into Eli's main house now that Effie's moved out because Auntie makes Yaya move in to take care of her brother. Affy still loves Eli and wishes that Eli had wanted her to be his only wife. His Only Wife was a fun read. I read it in 2 days while I was travelling. It's easy pick book to pick up and put down while you're journeying. The story is kind of really easy flowing to read. I enjoyed and appreciated the contemporary glimpse into an area of the world and culture that I personally was really unfamiliar with. And I definitely want to visit Ghana now and explore its yummy food scene. I'm not so sure about the cutthroat Accra traffic though. Additionally, I got to glimpse the interconnectedness between the countries in Africa. I was surprised at how many contacts happening. Characters are always jet-setting off to Côte d'Ivoire to school or Liberia for work, and also the huge popularity of the Nigerian movie industry was really highlighted in the book. Peace Azure Media is a lecturer of gender and international politics in Bristol University in England, and His Only Wife is her first novel. I can see how her expertise on gender influenced themes of women's agency and marriage and the economic impacts that these things have on women. Medea especially was skillful in weaving scenes and situations that conveyed familial dynamics. I really enjoyed her characterization of Uncle Pius and Olivia. The importance of marriage to women of an older generation is really well done. You really understand how marriage can influence women's status within families and in the broader African community. Afi's marriage returned the dignity that Olivia lost after her husband died, and in many ways Afi's rise in confidence also brought up Olivia's confidence in allowing her to leave Ho and her benefactor, Auntie. The success of Afi's marriage to Eli is important to many people, and it creates an immense pressure for Afi to act in a particular way. I was struck how the familial bonds, extended patronages, family obligations and responsibilities within the extended Ghanaian society were so similar to those that I know in South Asian communities. At the beginning of the story, Afi has a youthful naivety, but she's petulant and passive and a bit selfish, and by the end of the book she's definitely lost that naivety and grabbed her agency with both hands and learnt to sort of trust her inner voice after listening to so many diverse competing voices beside her for most of the book. At the end of the book, Afi is able to stand up to the demands and wishes of her husband, his family, her family, and understand what is truly important to her and fight for that. The characterizations of the females in the book are brilliant. All the women are different and are really strong characters in their own way, and I could understand their various points of view, might not agree with it, but could understand it, and also their different agendas. The only woman I didn't understand and whose voice I really didn't hear was Muna's. What made her tick? Why did she stay with Eli? Was it only about the money? Or did he have a depth we didn't see when he was with Afi? I also enjoyed the similarities some of the characters shared. Olivia and Muna were actually alike in some ways. They didn't allow their families or the men in their families to walk all over them and so were vilified. It was interesting literary device that Medea used, not naming Muna for much of the story. For much of the story she's known as the Liberian woman. This othered Muna and made her character a shadow kind of hang over Afi and her family, and really the book, a lot like Daphne du Maurier does in Rebecca. This was a brilliant touch. Medea also is great at building the tension between Afi's family and the Gagneurs. The male characters didn't have as much depth, though. I mean, good Lord, Eli and his brothers really needed to grow a backbone. Except for Uncle Pius, all the males seemed interchangeable, lacked depth, and seemed very hung up on themselves. The pacing of the book was a bit uneven. The middle of the story dragged a little, and the ending and the big reveal felt rushed and sudden. The book tells us Afi and Eli fall in love, but I wasn't really sure how they did that. The book doesn't really show us, it just tells us that they love each other, or Eli tells Afi he loves her, and Afi obviously tells Eli she loves him. And since we get to see her point of view, we know that. The other issue I had with the story, or really Afi, was that she went into the marriage knowing that Eli had a girlfriend, or wife if you want to think of it. But the whole time Afi acted as if she was being cheated on by Eli. That feelings of outrage should surely have belonged to Muna, who had been in Eli's life longer, had a child with him, and had built a life and a home with him, and really was effectively kicked out of her home and the life that she had built by Afi. Here are some book club questions. The importance of cooking and feeding a husband seems a defining trait of what a wife is and isn't in Ghanaian society. Eli is quite comfortable cooking and routinely brought takeout food. This irked Afi, who thought it was Eli's way of taking away her wifely duties. Do you think cooking defines a wife? If illustrious Afi's father had lived, do you think Afi would have ever married Eli? Evelyn tells Afi marriage should never be and not be a never-ending competition where you spend your life fighting to be seen and chosen. What do you think marriage should be like? What's your idea of a perfect marriage or a perfect union? Do you think you could be in a polygamous marriage? What would be the advantages and disadvantages? Do you think Afi should have been more pragmatic, accepted Muna in Eli's life and enjoyed the material, social and emotional things that she had as Eli's wife? Would you have accepted Muna? Why do you think Afi wants to be the only wife no matter what? I hope you get to read his Only Wife soon. Bye-bye!